When I got to the station near Grand's, I called them to tell them I'd gotten there. They asked to speak to Gran, but I said she was arranging for the taxi. They told me to call back as often as I wanted. I stood at the curb of the station, waiting for a taxi, and kept staring at that silly piece of paper. Then I threw it away. Why? Because keeping it felt too much like hurting myself. She sits up in the chair, crossing her legs at the knee, and leans her elbows against the table. You seem to have this strange image of me as a lost child, like I've just been thrown on the side of the road like garbage or roadkill. But kids like me, we're not lost. We may be the only ones who never are. We always know exactly where we are and where we can go, and where we can't. Victor shakes his head, unwilling to argue the point, but equally incapable of agreeing with it. Why didn't the girls in New York report you missing? She rolls her eyes. We didn't have that kind of relationship. But you were friends. Yes, friends who were all running from other things. Before I moved in, the bed was vacant because the last girl suddenly picked up and left. Hard on her heels was a pissed-off uncle who wanted to know what she'd done with a baby he'd raked into her 3 years before. No matter how carefully you hide, there's always someone who can find you. Only if they're looking. Or if you're really just that unlucky.
What do you mean? Asks Edison.
What, you think I wanted the gardener to kidnap me? The whole city to disappear in, but he found me?
That doesn't explain.
It does, she says simply, if you're a certain kind of person.
Victor sips his coffee, trying to decide if he should push the conversation in a necessary direction or let it go in what may or may not prove to be a useful one.
What kind of person, Inara? He prompts eventually.
If you expect to be overlooked or forgotten, you're always at least a little surprised when someone remembers you. You're always outside understanding those strange creatures who actually expect people to remember and come back.
She takes her time then, eating her cinnamon roll. But Victor can tell she isn't finished with the thought yet. Maybe it isn't fully formed yet. His youngest daughter will do that sometimes, just trail off until she knows the rest of the words. He isn't sure if that's Inara's reason, but it's still a pattern he knows. So he kicks Edison under the table to keep him silent when his partner's mouth opens. Edison glares at him and scoots his chair several inches away, but says nothing.
Sophia's girls expect her to come back, she continues softly.
She licks the icing off her injured fingers and winces.
They've been with their foster family for, well, they'd been there nearly 4 years when I was taken. Anyone could have understood if they'd given up hope. They didn't, though. No matter what happened, no matter how bad things got, they knew she was fighting for them. They know she will always, always come back for them. I don't get it. I don't think I ever will, but then I never had a Sophia.
But you have Sophia.
Had, she corrects. And it's not the same. I'm not her daughter.
Her family, though, yes.
Friends. It's not the same.
He's not sure he believes that. He's not sure she does either. Maybe it's easier for her to pretend she does.
Your girls always believe you'll come home, don't they, Agent Hanoverian?
She smooths a hand along the soft sleeve of the sweater.
They're afraid that one day you might die in the line of duty, but they don't believe anything could keep you away if you were still alive.
Keep your mouth off his girls, snaps Edison, and she smirks.
You can see his girls in his eyes every time he looks at me or one of those pictures. They're why he does what he does.
Yes, they are, Victor says, finishing his coffee. And one of them sent along something else for you.
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a tube of Deep Berry lip gloss. This is from my eldest, who also gave the clothing. It startles a smile from her, a real one that makes her whole face shine for a few seconds, her amber-flecked eyes crinkling at the corners.
Lip gloss.
She said it's a girl thing.
I'd hope so. This would be a very unflattering shade on you.
Gingerly unscrewing the cap, she squeezes the tube until a bead of shimmering color oozes from the end. She rolls it along her lower lip, managing the upper with no mess or missed places, despite her eyes never going to the one-way mirror.
We used to do our makeup on the train on the way to work. Most of us could put our whole face on without ever looking in a mirror.
I have to admit it's not something I've ever tried, he says dryly. Edison straightens the stack of papers, lining their edges precisely with the edge of the table. Victor watches him, used to his partner's compulsions, but still amused by them. Edison sees him watching and frowns.
Inara, Victor says finally, and she reluctantly opens her eyes. We need to start.
Des,
she sighs. He nods. Tell me about Desmond.
I was the only one who liked to find the high places in the garden, so I was the one to find the other garden. Up on the little cliff, there was this small stand of trees, and by stand I mean five, that grew right up against the glass. At least a couple times a week I climbed one of the trees, settled into the highest curve of branches that could support me, and pressed my cheek against the glass. Sometimes if I closed my eyes I could pretend I was out on our fire escape, against our bank of windows, hearing Sophia talk about her girls, or listening to a boy in another building play violin as Catherine sat beside me. To my front and left, I could see almost the entire garden, except for the hallways that wrapped around us and what was hidden by the edge of the cliff. In the afternoon, I could see the girls playing tag or hide-and-seek along the stream, one or two floating in the small pond or sitting among the rocks or bushes, with books and crosswords and various things. But I could also see out of the garden, just a little. As far as I could tell, the greenhouse we called the garden was actually one of two, one inside the other, like nesting dolls. Ours was the one in the center, impossibly tall, with our hallways wrapped around it in a square. The ceilings in our rooms weren't especially high, but the walls rose up all the way to the trees on the cliff, black and flat-topped, and on the other side, another glass roof, sloping down over another greenhouse. It was more of a border than a proper square on its own broad path, lined, at least on the side I could see, with plant life. It was hard to see, even from the tops of the trees. Just a sliver here or there, where the angle was just right. In that greenhouse was the real world, with gardeners no one hid from and doors that led outside, where the seasons changed and life didn't count down to 21. The real world had not the gardener, but the man non-butterflies knew him to be. A man who was involved with arts and philanthropy and some kind of business venture, or rather, many kinds of business ventures, from what he sometimes hinted. That man had a house somewhere on the property, not visible even from the trees. That man had a wife and family. Well, he had Avery, and clearly the asshole had to come from somewhere, but still. There was a wife. And she and the gardener walked through that outer greenhouse together almost every afternoon from 2 to 3, her hand tucked through his elbow for support. She was slender, almost to the point of sickliness, with dark hair and impeccable style. From so far away, that was all I could see. They'd walk slowly down the leg of the square, stopping from time to time to inspect a flower or plant more closely, and then slowly walk on, until they passed from my limited range of sight. They'd be back once or twice more before their walk was done. She was the one who determined their pace, and whenever she lagged, he'd turn to her solicitously. It was the same tenderness he showed to his butterflies, soft and sincere in a way that sent spiders crawling under my skin. It was the same tenderness with which he touched the glass of the display cases, with which he wept over Evita. It was in the way his hands trembled when he saw what Avery had done to me. It was love, as he knew it. 2 or 3 times a week, Avery accompanied them, trailing along behind and rarely staying for the full hour. He usually did a single revolution and then walked into the garden, where he looked for someone who was sweet and innocent and so easily gave him the fear he craved. And 2 times a week, on consecutive days that were the same as our maintenance mornings, there was a younger son, with his mother's dark hair and slim build. As with his mother, the detail was lost to distance, but it was clear she doted on him. When he joined them, she moved between her husband and younger son. For months, I watched them unobserved, until one day, the gardener looked up. Right at me. I kept my cheek pressed against the glass, curled within the leaves high in my tree, and didn't move. It was another 3 days before we spoke of it, and even then only over the bed of a stranger, not even a butterfly.
Victor takes a deep breath, pushing away that bizarre image of normalcy. Most of the sickos he arrests seem normal on the surface. He had kidnapped another girl? He took several a year, but never until the previous one was fully marked and more or less settled in. Why? Why he took several a year, or why he waited between them? Yes, Victor tells her, and she smirks. For the first, attrition. He never took more than the garden could support, so generally he only went shopping when one of the butterflies died. That wasn't always the case, but usually. For the second, she shrugs and presses her palms flat against the table, studying the stippling of burned tissue across the backs. A new girl was a stressful time in the garden. Everyone got on edge, remembering their own kidnapping and how it was when they woke up the first time. And then the inevitable tears just made it all worse. Once a new girl settled, things were quiet for a while, until the next death, the next wings on display, the next new girl. The gardener was always, mostly, exquisitely sensitive to the prevailing mood in the garden. Is that why he allowed Lionette to act as a guide? Because it helped, yes. Then how did you end up doing it? Because someone had to, and Bliss was too angry, the rest too skittish.
It wasn't the girl after me, but the next one that I first helped with. Because Avery had brought the flu into the garden, and it was cutting a hell of a swath through the girls. Lionette was a train wreck. She was pale and sweating, her tawny hair plastered to her neck and face, and the toilet bowl was a much truer friend than I could ever be. Bliss and I told her to stay in bed, to let the gardener deal with his own mess for once, but as soon as the walls lifted to let us out of our rooms, she pulled on clothes and staggered out into the hallway. Swearing, I tied on a dress and jogged after her, until I could loop one of her arms around my shoulders. She was so dizzy she couldn't walk without keeping a hand to the wall. She didn't flinch away from the display cases like she usually did, even after almost 5 years. Why does it have to be you?
Because it has to be someone, she whispered,
and stopped to swallow back her need to vomit. Again, even though she'd been kneeling in front of the toilet for most of the past 18 hours. I didn't agree, not at that point. Maybe not ever. The gardener was very, very good at guessing ages, better than any carnival whack I'd ever heard of. A few girls came in at 17, but most were 16. He wouldn't kidnap younger, and if he thought there was a chance of 15 or less, he said he chose someone else. But he tried not to go any older. I guess he wanted the full 5 years whenever possible. The things that man felt comfortable talking about with his captives. Or maybe just with me. The new girl was in a room that was every bit as naked as the one I'd woken up in. Mine was slowly starting to accumulate personal touches, but for now she had a plain gray fitted sheet and nothing else. Her skin tone was dark and, combined with the cast of her features, suggested mixed race, Mexican and African, I'd find out later. She wasn't much taller than Bliss, And except for a rather astonishing set of tits that looked like they'd been a quinceanera gift, she was reed slender. Small holes marched all the way up one ear and most of the other. Another hole on the edge of her nostril and yet another around her navel suggested they'd been pierced as well. Why'd he take them all out?
Maybe he thought they were tacky,
groaned Lionette, sinking to the floor beside the unshielded toilet. My ears were double pierced when I came, still are.
Maybe he thinks yours are classy.
Plus the cartilage cuff on the right.
Maya, don't be a bitch. This is rough enough, all right?
Surprisingly, that actually was enough to make me stop. It wasn't just that she was clearly pathetic at the moment. It was also the undercurrent. Trying to make sense of why the gardener did what he did was an exercise in futility and completely unnecessary besides. We didn't need to know why, we just needed to know what. Not that you're actually capable of going anywhere, but wait here. She flapped her hand and closed her eyes. There were two refrigerators in the kitchen attached to our dining room. One held our meal ingredients and was always kept locked, Lorraine having the only key. The other held drinks and what snacks we were allowed to have between meals. I grabbed a couple bottles of water for Lionette and a juice for myself, then pillaged a book from the library to read aloud to her while we waited for the new girl to wake up.
There was a library? Edison asks incredulously. Well, yeah. He wanted us to be happy there. That meant keeping us occupied. What kind of books did he give you? Whatever we asked for, really.
She shrugs and settles back into her chair, arms crossed loosely over her chest.
It was mostly classics at first, but those of us who genuinely enjoyed reading started a wish list by the doorway. And every now and then he'd add a few dozen or so volumes. And some of us had personal books, direct gifts from him, that stayed in our rooms.
And you were one of the readers.
She starts to give him a disgusted look, then reconsiders.
Oh, right, you weren't here for that part.
What part?
The part where I explained that being in the garden was usually boring as fuck.
If that's boring, you're clearly not doing it right, he mutters, and it startles a laugh out of her.
It wasn't boring when it was my choice, she admits, but that was before the garden.
Victor knows he should drag the conversation back to the original question, but the sight of the two of them in agreement about something is far too entertaining, so he lets it go. Even ignores the slight trace of a lie in the girl's face.
And I suppose your favorite was Poe?
Oh, no. Poe had a purpose, to distract. I liked the fairy tales, not the watered-down Disney shit or the sanitized Perro versions. I liked the real ones, where horrible things happened to everyone and you really understood it wasn't intended for children.
No illusions, Victor asks, and she nods.
Exactly.
New Girl took a long time to regain consciousness, long enough that Lionette even debated sending for Lorraine. I talked her out of it. If the girl was going to die from it, there was little enough our nurse could do to prevent it, and that pinch-faced bitch wasn't the first thing I would want to see. Lionette used that to insist I be the first thing New Girl saw. Given that Lionette looked like death warmed over, I didn't even argue. Much. It was late in the afternoon before the girl finally stirred, and I closed Oliver Twist on a finger to see if she was actually waking up. We got another 2 hours of reading in before you could call her any sort of coherent. Under Lionette's instructions, I poured a glass of water to have ready and wet down a few cloths to help against the headache. When I folded one of them under the girl's neck, she batted at my hand and swore at me in Spanish. Good enough. Eventually, she gathered enough of her wits to pull the washcloths away from her face and try to sit up, her entire body swaying with the force of her nausea. Careful there, I said quietly. Here's some water, it'll help.
Get away from me, you sick fuck.
I'm not the one who kidnapped you, so save it. Either you want the water and aspirin, or you can eat shit and die. Your choice. Lionette groaned.
Maya.
The girl blinked at me, but meekly took the pills and the cup. Better. You're being held by a man known as the Gardener. He gives us new names, so don't bother telling us yours. Remember it, but don't say it. I'm called Maya, and the lovely one with the flu over there is Lionette. I'm no one, I reminded her sharply. Not until he gives you a name. Don't make it harder than it has to be.
Maya.
I glanced over at Lionette, who was giving me the pathetic, exasperated, incredulous, what-the-fuck-are-you-doing-to-me look she usually reserved for Evita. You do it, then. You weren't the first face she saw. Hooray! Now you can take over if you don't like how I'm doing it. I'd had Sophia as a maternal example for young children. New Girl wasn't that young, and I wasn't Sophia. Lionette closed her eyes and whispered a prayer for patience. Before she could finish, though, she had to fold herself over the toilet bowl again. The new girl's hands started to shake, so I took them between my own. It was always warm in the garden, except sometimes in the cave behind the waterfall, but I knew the shivers were from shock more than anything. Here's the thing, and it's terrifying and bewildering and fuck all unfair, but it's still the thing. We are here as the unwilling guests of a man who will come to you for company, and, as often as not, sex. Sometimes his son will come to you. You belong to them now, and they will do what they want to you, including mark you as theirs. There are quite a few of us here, and we support each other as we can, but the only way you're getting out of here is to die. So you're going to have to decide if this life of ours is better or worse than death.
Suicide is a mortal sin, she whispered.
Good, that means you're not too likely to want to off yourself.
Jesus, Maya, why not just hand her some rope?
The girl swallowed hard, but, God love her for it, squeezed my hands.
How long have you been here?
About 4 months. She looked over at Lionette.
Almost 5 years, she murmured.
If I'd known then. But it didn't matter, it never did. Knowing it didn't change anything.
And you're still alive? And Mama always says, where there's life, there's hope. A hope.
Just be careful with the hope, I cautioned her. A little is fine, too much is crippling.
Maya.
So, new girl, want to take a tour?
I'm naked.
Not so much a thing here. You'll get used to it.
Maya!
Did you bring a dress? I asked pointedly, and Lionette flushed beneath her sickly pallor. And I'm not letting her borrow yours. You've probably puked all down the front. She hadn't, but her black dress went all the way to the floor. No way tiny little new girl was going to manage in that. I would have loaned her mine if it would be any better. Wait here, I sighed. I'll get something from Bliss. Our friend wasn't in her room when I got there, so I just grabbed something and returned to the new girl's room, which was, as ever, studiously avoided by the other butterflies. She made a face at the black fabric. Even I had to admit it wasn't a flattering color on her. But you learned to fear colored clothing in the garden. When you were given something other than black, it was because that was the gown the gardener wanted you to die in. She obeyed when I told her not to look in the hallway. Even I wasn't so much of a bitch as to show her that right off. She was at the far end of the garden from my room, just down the hall from Lionette's, and bordering one side of the no-man's land that held the rooms we weren't supposed to go in, the door to outside that we were supposed to pretend didn't exist. From that position, she was able to see the full breadth of the garden in one look, all the rich, growing things, the vibrant flowers and white sand paths, the waterfall and stream and pond, the cliff, all the tiny stands of trees, the actual butterflies hovering over plants, and the clear glass roof that seemed so impossibly far away. She burst into tears. Lionette lurched forward but pulled back immediately in a violent shivering fit. The flu probably wasn't the best way to welcome someone to our verdant cage. I just wasn't that maternal. As amply evidenced, I watched the new girl as she crumpled to the ground, curled into a tiny ball, as she clutched her arms across her stomach like this was a physical blow she could ward off. Eventually, when the heaving, soul-shattering sobs had trailed off into whimpers and gasps for breath, I sank down onto my knees beside her, one hand on her yet unmarked back. This isn't the worst pain, I told her as gently as I could. But I think it's the worst shock. From here on out, you can expect it a little. At first I wasn't sure if she'd heard me, because the whimpers continued unabated. Then she threw herself to the side, wrapping her arms around my waist and burying her face in my lap, as her shock and grief deepened into full-throated sobs once more. I didn't pet or stroke her, didn't move my hand. She'd learned to hate that gesture from the gardener. But I kept my hand against her warm skin, so she knew I was there.
"Do you still have the hallway pictures in here?" she asks abruptly, and the agents shake themselves from the spell of her words. It's Edison who hands her the stack, his fists clenched against his thighs, as he watches her riffle through them. She pulls out a photo, stares at it for a moment, then places it face up on the table where the men can see. "A Chiricahua white." She traces a finger over the sharp delineation of white and black on the wings. "He named her Johanna." Victor blinks. "Johanna. I don't know that there was a system to how he named us. I think he just looked through names until he found one he liked. I mean, she sure as hell didn't look like a Johanna, but whatever." Victor forces himself to examine the wings in the glass. She's right. The girl was tiny, though her exact height is difficult to gauge from her position. What happened to her?
She was mercurial. For the most part, she seemed to settle in okay, but then suddenly she'd get these mood swings that sent a storm through the whole garden. And then Lionette died, and then the gardener brought in a new girl.
He clears his throat when she doesn't go on. "What happened to her?" he asks again, and Inara sighs.
"The walls came down so the gardener could get the new girl for a tattoo session, but Johanna managed to stay out in the garden. When the walls went up, we found her in the pond."
In one fluid motion, she grabs the photo and slams it face down on the metal.
"So much for mortal sin."
Sliding another stack of photos and papers before him, Victor silently sifts through them until he finds the one he's looking for. It's a young man, probably a little older than he looks, with artistically disheveled hair so dark brown it's nearly black. Pale green eyes stand out sharply in a slender, pale face. He's a good-looking boy, even in this over-pixelated likeness, someone who, at least by appearance, he wouldn't mind Holly bringing home for him to meet. He should bring the conversation back to this boy. Not yet. Just a little longer. He isn't sure if it's for her benefit or his own. "When the gardener noticed you in the trees."
"What of it?"
"You said he came to talk to you over a stranger's bed. Was this the girl after Johanna?" It's not a smile, more like a grimace to acknowledge his statement.
"No, the one after that."
A little longer.
"What did her name end up being?"
She closes her eyes.
"She never got one."
"Why wouldn't..."
"Timing. Sometimes that's all it came down to."
She had skin like ebony, almost blue-black against the dove-gray fitted sheet, with a smoothly shaven head and features that wouldn't have been out of place on the walls of an Egyptian tomb. In the days following Lionette's death, I desperately needed something, anything to do, but unlike Bliss and Lionette, I had neither talent nor interest in creating things. I read, and read a lot, but I didn't make anything of my own. Bliss buried herself in polymer clay, filling the oven with figurines, half of which she later destroyed in fits of temper. But I didn't have that outlet, either the making or the destroying. 3 days later, though, the gardener brought in the new girl, and there was no more Lionette to give her a graceful introduction. None of the other girls wanted to go near her until she was settled, and I wondered just how long Lionette had been doing her job that no one else even seemed to think about it. In the days following Johanna's death, I'd wondered how much, if at all, I was to blame for her choice. If I'd given her a more graceful introduction to her situation, if I'd been more sympathetic or more comforting, maybe she would have been able to cling to that hope her mama told her to have. Or maybe not. Maybe that first view of the garden, that first moment where it was real, was what made the difference. It wasn't like I could ask her. So I stuck with the new girl, as patient with her as I could be, and tucked the more acerbic comments away. Considering how frequently she burst into tears, it took more patience than I knew I had. Bliss rescued me sometimes. Not by coming herself, that would have been a very bad idea, but by sending Evita to be sweet and sincere and in many ways such a better person than I could ever hope to be. The day after the third of her tattoo sessions, I stayed with her through the evening until her drugged dinner took effect. Normally that's when I left, but I'd seen something I wanted to investigate without alarming her, which meant she needed to be fully asleep. Even after her deep, steady breathing and the way all the tension left her body told me she was asleep, I let the drug work even further. Maybe an hour after she fell asleep, I set aside my book and rolled her over onto her stomach. She usually slept on her back, but the process of the tattoo made her sleep on her side to keep pressure off the tender areas. The butterfly book in the library, with Lionette's handwriting scrawled in the margins, listing names and locations in the halls, told me the gardener had chosen a falcate orange tip for her, mostly white with a splash of orange on the edge of each upper wing. He liked to choose white and the palest yellows for the darker-skinned girls, for some reason. I guess he was afraid the darker colors wouldn't show with the same clarity? For this one, he'd finished the orange and moved into the white sections, and something about them just looked wrong. Now that I could actually bend close to see it without giving her alarm, I could see the added puffiness, the scale-like swellings under the ink, the way the white bubbled grotesquely in huge blisters. The orange wingtips were nearly as bad. Tracing in closer to her spine, even the black outlines and veins purled. I pulled out one of my earrings. The gardener never had taken them, and used the post to carefully pierce one of the smaller blisters. Mostly clear fluid leaked out from the tiny puncture, but when I pressed down gently, a milky white spilled out as well. I washed the earring off in the sink and replaced it in my ear as I tried to think of a solution. I couldn't be sure if she was reacting to the inks or to the needles, but there was definitely an allergic reaction of some sort. Not immediately life-threatening, like a peanut allergy can be, but it wasn't letting the ink heal. Infection could kill just as much as a histamine response, or so Lorraine had told us on one of her rare friendly days. Of course, she'd been causing Bliss all sorts of pain by digging around in her feet for splinters, so that probably contributed to the good mood. For lack of a better idea, I returned to the girl's side and tried to measure how bad the reaction was in each area. I'd gotten through the orange and half the white when I felt the change. The gardener was there. He leaned against the doorway, thumbs hooked through the pockets of his pressed khakis. Lights were going out all over the garden as girls went to bed, waiting to see if this would be the night they'd be required to entertain their captor. He'd never called for Lionette when she was settling a new girl, but then, I wasn't Lionette.
"You look worried," he said, instead of a greeting.
I gestured to the girl's back. She's not going to heal. As he stepped into the room, he unbuttoned his cuffs and rolled the sleeves of his dark green shirt up to his elbows. The color made his pale eyes glow against his face. He pressed against her back with gentle hands, finding the same things I did, and gradually the concern changed to a look of deep sorrow.
"Everyone reacts differently to tattoos."
I should have felt sorrow, or rage, or confusion. All I felt was numb. "What do you do with the girls who never get their full wings?" I asked quietly. He gave me a swift, thoughtful look, and I wondered if I was the first girl to ever ask that.
"I see them properly buried on the estate."
Edison growls and reaches for his notebook. "Did he say where on the estate?"
"No, but I think it overlooked a river. Sometimes he'd come to the garden with mud on his shoes and this wistful look on his face. And on those days, he'd give Bliss river stones to use as a base for some of her figures. Nothing I could see from the trees."
He balls up the aluminum foil and tosses it at the one-way mirror. Get a team out to the riverbank. Look for graves.
You could say please.
I'm giving them an assignment, not asking for a favor.
He retorts through gritted teeth. She shrugs.
Julian always said please. Rebecca, too, even when she was just assigning sections. But then I guess that's why I loved working for Julian. He made it a very pleasant and respectful place.
She might as well have slapped him in the face. Victor sees the angry flush climb up from his partner's collar and looks away so he won't smile, or at least so Edison won't see it.
Was it just the girls who died before the wings were finished?
He asks quickly.
No, if they died in such a way that it ruined the wings, he didn't display them. Avery put several girls into the ground instead of the glass when he whipped them hard enough to scar across the ink.
She lightly touches her neck.
Giselle.
That wasn't where the conversation ended, was it?
No, but you already know that.
Yes, but I'd like to hear the rest, he replies, just as he would to his daughters.
She quirks an eyebrow at him.
Like Lionette had, I usually borrowed a stool from the infirmary to keep beside the girl's bed. Sitting on the bed probably would have been fine, but this gave her a little space. Gave her a territory that was hers. The gardener didn't really recognize territory in that way. He sat with his back against the headboard, placing the girl's head in his lap so he could run his hand over her shaven skull. So far as I knew, he never visited the girls in their rooms until after they were fully marked. Until after he'd raped them for the first time. After all, that was what made them his. But then he wasn't there to see the new girl, he was there to talk to me. And he didn't seem in any big hurry to do it. I pulled my ankles up onto the seat, sitting cross-legged on the narrow stool, and spread my book across my lap, reading to fill the empty space, until he reached over and gently closed it. Then I gave him my attention.
How long have you been watching my family?
Nearly since my wings were done.
But you haven't said anything.
Not to you or anyone. Not even to Lionette or Bliss, though I'd been tempted. I wasn't sure why. Maybe it was easier to think of him as just our captor? Putting a family in there made it... well, more wrong, somehow. Just the fact that it could be more wrong was disturbing enough.
And what do you think when you see us?
I think your wife is sick. I rarely lied to the gardener. The truth was the one thing that could always be mine. I think she's scared of Avery and doesn't want to show it. And I think she dotes on your younger boy. I think she treasures those walks with you as the only time she has your undivided attention.
All that from a stand of trees.
Thank God he looked more amused than anything. He settled his back more comfortably against the headboard, one arm bent behind him to act as a cushion for his head. Am I wrong?
No.
He looked down at the girl in his lap, then back at me.
She's been struggling for years against a heart condition. It isn't severe enough that she qualifies for a transplant, but it causes a significant drop in quality of life.
So his wife was a kind of butterfly, too. That's one.
And she does dote on our younger son. She's quite proud of him. He keeps perfect grades, is always polite, and is a treat to hear on the piano and violin.
That's two.
Between the garden and my business, and her own charitable functions and planning, our schedules are often in conflict. We both make time for our afternoon walks, unless we're out of town. It's good for her heart.
That's three. And all that was left was the hard one, the one no parent wants to admit. So he didn't. He left it unsaid, and in the silence there was truth.
You pay a great deal of attention to things, don't you, Maya? To people, to patterns, to events. You find more meaning than others.
I pay attention, I agreed. I don't know that I find more meaning.
You observed a walk in a greenhouse and made it mean all that.
I didn't make it mean anything. I just noticed body language. Body language was one of the things that told me my next-door neighbor was a pedophile long before the first time he exposed himself, long before the first time he touched me or asked me to touch him. It was in the way he watched me and the other kids in the neighborhood, in the bruised looks of the foster kids who lived with him. I was prepared for his advances because I knew they'd be coming. Body language warned me about Grand's lawn guy, about the kids in school who would try to beat you up just because they could. Body language was better than a flashing light for warnings. And body language told me that as much as he wanted to seem perfectly relaxed right now, he couldn't. I don't intend to tell anyone, you know. There it was. Not all of the tension left his body, but most of it. Except when his lust got the better of him, he was a remarkably self-contained man. We don't know about them. And they don't know about us, do they?
No, he whispered. Some things.
He never did finish that thought. Not out loud, at least.
I would never willingly hurt Eleanor.
I didn't know his name, but now I knew his wife's. And your son?
Desmond.
He actually seemed surprised for a moment, then shook his head.
Desmond is very different from Avery.
Even then, all I could think was, thank God. He lifted the girl's head from his lap and eased off the bed, extending his hand to me.
I'd like to ask you something, if I may.
I wasn't sure why asking me something would involve moving, but I obediently stood and took his hand, leaving the book on the stool. The girl wouldn't be awake until morning, so I wasn't strictly needed at her bedside. He walked us through the hallways, absently touching each occupied display case as he passed. If I'd had a mind to, I could have asked him to name them, and he could have. Every single name, every single butterfly, he knew, and remembered them all. I never wanted to know. I thought he was taking me to my room, but he turned aside at the last moment and led us into the cave behind the waterfall. Except for the moonlight that filtered through the glass roof of the greenhouse and fractured through the falling water, the cave was completely dark. Oh, and the blinking red eye of the camera. We stood in silence in the darkness, listening to the waterfall hit the stream and the decorative rocks. Pia, who'd been there about a year longer than I had a theory that there were pipes in the bottom of the pond that kept the water at a certain level by draining it and funneling it through another pipe way up to the tiny pond atop the cliff that fed into the waterfall. She was probably right. Given that I couldn't swim, I never tried to go down to the bottom of the pond to see for sure. Pia liked to poke at things and figure out how they worked. When the walls came up to reveal Johanna and Glass, Pia went to the pond and said there were sensors along the edge now.
I've wondered about what draws you to this place,
he said after a time.
The cliff top, I can almost understand. It's open, it's free, the height gives you a sense of safety. But this place, what can this cave offer you?
The ability to say whatever the fuck I want to without worrying about reprisals, because the roaring of the waterfall was strong enough to obscure whatever the mics might pick up. But he was looking for something more personal than that, something with the meaning he thought I gave everything. It took me a minute or two to come up with that answer for him, something close enough to truth.
There's no illusion in here, I said finally.
It's not lush and green and growing and waiting for death and the possibility of decay. It's just rock and water. Here the girls and I sat face to face and knee to knee, and it was usually easy to pretend there were no butterflies. The suck-ups had the wings marked around their eyes like carnival masks, but even then, in the misty dimness of the cave, it was easy to think it a trick of the shadows. We'd take our hair down, put our backs against the rocks, and there were no fucking butterflies. Just for a few moments. So perhaps there was illusion in here after all, but it was our illusion, not one he'd manufactured for us. He dropped my hand, and then he was pulling out all the pins that kept my hair up in its braided crown, until it fell in a crimped mass to my hips, hiding the wings. It was the one thing he never did, unless he was brushing it out. But he just left it down around me, tucking the pins into the breast pocket of his shirt.
"You are quite unlike any of the others," he said eventually.
"Not entirely true. I had a temper like Bliss, only I didn't let it go. I had impatience like Lionette, which I did my best to spread out. I read like Zara, ran like Glennis, danced like Ravenna, and braided hair like Haley. I had bits and pieces of most of the others in me, save for Evita's sweet simplicity. The only thing that made me truly different was that I was the only one who never cried. Who never could. Fucking carousel.
You put requests for books on the lists, but never overtly ask for anything. You assist the other girls, you listen to them, calm them. You keep their secrets, and apparently mine as well. But you give no one else secrets to keep for you.
My secrets are old friends. I would feel like a poor friend if I abandoned them now. His low chuckle echoed around the chamber before the waterfall swallowed the sound.
I'm not asking you to share them, Maya. Your life before is your own.
She gives Edison a pointed look, and Victor can't help but laugh. I'm not going to apologize, Edison tells her bluntly. This is my job, and we have to know the truth to put together a strong case against him. The doctors are fairly confident he'll survive to stand trial.
Pity.
A trial means justice, he snaps.
In a sense, sure.
In a sense, it...
Does justice change any of what he did? Any of what we went through? Does it bring the girls in glass back to life?
Well, no, but it keeps him from doing it again.
So would his death, and without the sensationalism and tax money.
Back to the waterfall, Victor announces over the beginning of Edison's protest.
Spoilsport, mutters the girl.
Ask me for one thing, Maya.
There was a challenge in his eyes, layered through his voice. He expected me to ask for something impossible, like freedom. Or maybe he expected me to be like Lorraine, to ask for something that could have gotten me out of the garden, but wasn't freedom at all. I knew better than that. Like throwing away well-intentioned phone numbers, I knew better than to ask for things I clearly couldn't have. Can this one camera be disabled without another one going up in its place? I asked promptly, and watched shock pass across his shadowed face. No cameras, no mics.
That's it.
It would be nice to have one place that's genuinely private, I explained with a shrug. It almost felt strange to have my hair shifting across my back and shoulders with the gesture. You can see us everywhere else we go. Even watch us on the toilet if you had a wish to. Having just a single place devoid of cameras would be beneficial. A mental health exercise, in a way. He watched me for a long time before answering.
Something that benefits all of you.
Yes.
I tell you to ask for anything, and you ask for something that benefits all of you.
It benefits me, too? He laughed again and reached for me, pulling me against his chest so he could kiss me. His hands moved over the fastenings of my dress, and as he lowered me to the mist-damp stone, I closed my eyes and let my thoughts drift off to Annabel Lee and her grave in the kingdom by the sea. I didn't think angels would ever be jealous of me.
It's astonishing how much of a question she can answer without ever actually answering the question. There's a small, inappropriate part of Victor that would love to put her on the stand right now and watch both sets of lawyers tear their hair out in frustration. Even when she seems forthcoming, her answers almost always veer sideways, providing something like substance without giving away the heart. Ask about the boy, and she starts there, or seems to, and somehow it ends up in a completely different conversation.
and the boy is barely glimpsed. Yes, the lawyers will hate her come trial. He shoves the impulse aside and takes the picture of the boy from its stack, setting it on the table so she can see it right side up. She looks away at first, eyes flicking to the mirror, to the floor, to her burned and cut-up hands, before a sigh shudders through her body, and she turns her face to the photo. She lifts it gently by the edges, studying the unenhanced blow-up from his driver's license. The glossy paper trembles in her grasp, but no one mentions that.
"You get used to things in the garden," she says pensively. "Even the new girls coming in are something you just get used to, something you expect when another one dies. And then suddenly, everything changes."
When?
Just shy of 6 months ago, a few days after Evita died.
Maybe it was that Evita was one of those people you couldn't help but love. Maybe it was that her death was an accident, nothing we could have prepared for. Maybe it was the gardener's reaction, the openness of it. Whatever it was, the garden stank of despair in the days following Evita's accident. Most of the girls kept to their rooms, and Lorraine had to put all the meals on trays and bring them to us, and God, didn't that piss her off to no end. Of course, she was in a mood, same as the rest of us, though for a different reason. We mourned Evita. She mourned another filled display case that didn't include her. Sick fuck. I left my room at night, unable to bear the four walls in silence. We weren't coming into a weekend, so I didn't have to worry about maintenance or the solid walls coming down. There wasn't a reason in the world I couldn't spend the night wandering around. Sometimes the illusion of freedom, of choice, was more painful than captivity. It's not like the gardener couldn't find me if he wanted me, though he was with someone else. At night, the garden was mostly silent. There was the waterfall, of course, and the babble of the stream, the hum of machinery and moving air, and the muffled sound of girls crying from scattered points on the perimeter. But compared to the day, it was close enough to silent. I took my book and book light up the cliff to sit on one of the large rocks. I called it the sunbathing rock. Bliss called it pride rock and laughed when I dared her to find a lion to dangle off the edge. She made one, from polymer clay, and when I'd managed to start breathing again from laughing so hard, she gave him to me. He lived on the shelf above my bed, along with the other things most precious to me. I guess he's there still. Or was, until... Bliss joined me up on the cliff, around midnight, tossing me a figurine. I held it under the booklight to discover a dragon curled around itself. It was dark blue, his head hunched into his shoulders, and somehow the shape of the brow ridge over huge black eyes gave him the most pathetic look a clay figure could possibly have. "Why is he so sad?" She glared at me. "Right." The dragon's home was next to Simba, and where the lion was just a joke, the dragon actually came to mean something. But that day he was new, and sad, and Bliss was angry and sad. So I rested him on my knee and went back to reading Antigone until she felt up to saying something.
"If my room is intact, do you think there's a chance of my getting the figures back? And the origami menagerie? And the, well, all of it, really?"
"We can ask." Victor hedges, and she sighs. "Why Antigone?" Edison asks.
"I always thought she was pretty cool. She's strong and brave and resourceful, not above a certain level of emotional manipulation, and she dies, but on her own terms. She's sentenced to live out the rest of her days in a tomb, and she says, 'Fuck that, I'm gonna hang myself.' And then there's her betrothed, who loves her so much that he flips his shit at her death and tries to kill his own father. And then, of course, he dies too, because, come on, it's a Greek tragedy. And the Greeks and Shakespeare really love killing people off. It's a great lesson, really. Everyone dies."
She lays the photo down and covers the boy's face with her hands. Victor can't be sure she even realizes she's done it.
"But I might have picked something else if I'd known Bliss was going to join me." Oh?
It seemed to inspire her.
She paced around me as I read, snatching leaves off plants and shredding them as she walked, until you could follow her progress by the slaughter of green bits on the rock. She snarled and swore with every step, so I didn't bother to look up until she fell silent. She stood on the very edge of the false cliff, her toes curled over the rock, with her arms spread wide beside her. Her pale skin glowed in the moonlight where it showed through the gaps in her knee-length black dress. "I could jump," she whispered. "But you won't." "I could," she insisted, and I shook my head. "But you won't." "I will." "No, you won't." "Then why the fuck not?" she demanded, spinning to face me with her fists planted on her hips. "Because you can't guarantee that you would die, and if you were injured, it might not be badly enough for him to kill you. It's not that high a fall."
"Evita fell from lower."
"Evita broke her neck on a tree branch. You have luck like mine. If you tried, you'd fuck it up and be fine, except for a few bruises."
"God fucking damn it!"
She flopped beside me on the stone, her face buried in her arms as she wept. Bliss had been there 3 months longer than I had. 21 months for her.
"Why? Isn't there a better option?"
"Johanna drowned herself. Think that's less painful than an uncertain fall?"
"Pia says it won't work. He added sensors in the bank. If the water rises, it sends him an alarm and he can check the cameras. She said you can see the nearest cameras move to focus on whoever's swimming."
"If you waited till he was out of the house, or even out of town, it would probably give you enough time to drown if you really wanted to."
"I don't want to drown,"
she sighed, sitting up to mop at her tears with her dress.
"I don't want to die."
"Everyone dies."
"Then I don't want to die now," she snarled.
"Then why jump?"
"You have absolutely no sense of sympathy."
Not entirely true, and she knew it, but true enough. I closed the book and turned off the book light, setting them both on the ground with the sad little dragon on top of them so I could twist onto my stomach to lie alongside her.
"I get so sick of this place," she whispered,
and even though we weren't in the cave, the one place we were truly private, I thought she'd probably said it softly enough to avoid getting picked up. None of us knew if he went back through the recordings, never knew if it was safe to talk, even when we knew for a fact he wasn't sitting at a monitor.
"We all do."
"Then why can't I make the best of it like you do?" "You had a happy home, right?"
"Right."
"That's why you can't make the best of it." I'd been happy in the apartment, which had eventually become home, but I'd lived through bad things before getting there. So I'd lived through bad things before coming here. Bliss never had, or at least not nearly to the same extent. She had too much good to compare this to.
"Tell me something from before."
"You know I won't."
"Not something personal, just something."
"One of my neighbors had a weed garden on the roof," I said after a moment. "When I moved there, it was just a corner, but as time went by and no one reported it, it expanded until it covered half the roof. Some of the children from the lower floors used to play hide-and-seek in it. Eventually, though, someone tipped off the police, and he saw them coming, panicked, and set the whole damn crop on fire. We were all a little bit high for a week, and we had to wash everything we owned multiple times to get the smell out." Bliss shook her head.
"I can't even imagine."
"That's not a bad thing." "I'm forgetting things from home," she confessed.
"I was trying to remember my street address earlier, and I couldn't remember if it was a road or an avenue or a street or what. I still can't. 10929 Northwest 58th... something."
Which was really what all the fuss came down to. I shifted to lay one of my hands over hers, because there was nothing I could say.
"Every morning when I wake up and every night before I fall asleep, I tell myself my name, my family's names. I remind myself what they looked like."
I'd seen Bliss's family, a collection of clay figures. She made so many figures that there was no reason to give this set any special significance, unless you noticed the glossy parts where her fingers had worn the clay smooth, or that they were positioned in such a way that they were the first and last things she saw in a day. Maybe the gardener was right, and I do give everything a meaning. What happens when that isn't enough? Keep reminding yourself.